Today's guest is a big one. It is Formula One fast man, Valtteri Bottas. Today's podcast, we're going to talk a little bit about his F1 career, but I want to dig into talking cycling. Bottas has recently started riding the bike. We're going to talk about his new event in Finland, Finland Gravel, and his relationship with cycling as a conditioning tool and for fun and enjoyment. Let's dive in and talk with fast man, Mr. Valtteri Bottas. Valtteri, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
A prerequisite in gravel cycling seems to be strong mullet and strong moustache game. You've gone hard on that. You focused big on it.
Yeah, I feel like there's a bit of performance with that combo, so I would agree.
Was that much of a focus in your off-season training, just getting to the barber, going to him with a real vision for what this mullet could become?
You know, with me, things just normally happen. And yeah, this winter, well, summer in Australia that I had, the golden mullet happened. I just keep telling everyone that it was the Australian sun that bleached my hair. But like I said, things just happen, and now it's golden mullet.
What's Tiffany think of it?
She likes it. At least that's nice. What she says.
So I won't hear any different from her.
Yeah.
Maybe it's an obvious question, but did your interest in cycling, did it predate your relationship?
Yeah, probably. I did always like cycling. I always rode my bike, part of my physical training. But to be honest, before I met Tiffany, it was more like once, maximum twice a week, versus now it's 5 to 7 days a week.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah. I mean, when I get a chance to ride, then I do. Obviously, I travel a lot. I've got lots of other things going on than just the driving. But when the bike is available, when I have time, I'm always out there.
So. You travel with a bike?
Yeah, I do. I do travel with the bike. But also now, this year, I've started to get quite a nice setup in terms of bicycles. So I've got a couple of bikes in Australia where I'm actually about to travel tonight. Then I've got my bikes in Europe, in Finland, and about to get some bikes in US as well. So that's going to help with the calendar.
Nice. How does it work for you guys? Are you flying private, or are you crammed into Ryanair with your bike trying to con the baggage man that your bike's only 23 kilograms when it's actually like 48?
Yeah, so all the long haul flights, like overseas, I do commercial. Then I travel with my bike back if I don't have a bike there. But in Europe, yeah, fortunately can travel privately quite a bit. So that helps for sure.
I love that visual that you're still trying to play the same game we're all playing of trying to pretend your bike bag is underweight when it's overweight so you don't get pinged for excess.
Yeah, I know. It's, it's pain in the ass sometimes, but it's always worth it.
Is it in your F1 contract anything about cycling, gravel? Because you know the line between gravel cycling and mountain biking, it's pretty thin these days. I raced Santa Val in Girona a couple of months ago, and honestly, it was like a mountain bike race. It was dangerous in parts on a gravel bike. And I know Lance Stroll, if I remember, had a bad crash on his bike last year and ended up missing some races. Is it built into your contract that you can't do certain things?
There's nothing about cycling. So thank God that's allowed. And I think it's going to be fine as long as I don't hurt myself, you know. So when I do like gravel events and training rides, I kind of always need to leave bit of margin in some situations, and you know, just try and look at the big picture and make sure that at least I don't cause any trouble. But then of course there's other riders and you never know what happens on the road, etc. But yeah, thankfully nothing about cycling, so that's all allowed, even racing. But there's some other things like free climbing is banned, which I wouldn't really want to do anyway with other ropes. Then there's like people find it normally quite interesting. Diving is actually banned because it can mess with if something happens, it can mess with your inner ear and that way with your balance, which obviously you need for driving.
Like, I've never wanted to do free climb. Like, I watch Alex Honnold on the wall and I'm like, that looks crazy. But I think as soon as somebody told me I couldn't do it, then I'd be like, no, I want to go free climb.
Yeah. So maybe I'll try one day, but not in the next years.
What's the role of the bike, like, formally? Is there, obviously you guys are working with conditioning coaches. Is the bike built in as part of your training? Do you have a cycling specific coach, or is it more just into your overall conditioning ecosystem?
Well, I have some goals in cycling. Like, I always want to improve year by year my performance on the bike, and it is all the training that I do. Cycling is definitely by far in hours the number one that I do. But especially when the season, my racing season gets closer with motorsports, then I need to do more specific training, bit more gym work, and try to mix it up a bit more, not just to ride my bike. But then in season, it's a combination normally of gym and bike riding. But it works for me. I feel good in the car. And obviously, with traveling, with time differences, I do need to limit my hours, sometimes more than I would like to. But that's how it is, because in the end, I need to have good energy going into every Formula One race weekend.
Yeah, because that's something with cycling, isn't it? And I've even talked to World Tour riders about this. Like, we all seem to have a tolerance threshold for cycling. I know for me, we're trying to do the podcast. Everyone's like, oh, you still have so much available time that you're full time on the podcast. It's like, yeah, but if I do a 3-hour ride in the morning and I come back then to do a podcast interview, I'm just toast. I can't think of anything to say. I'm just like, oh, leave me alone. I want to sit on the couch and watch Netflix.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, the hours that pro men do, yeah, that would be not really possible for me with my schedule and obviously with my main focus being Formula One. That's a no-go. But yeah, when I have like weeks off or weekends off, then I try to get my long rides in. But then on the race week, obviously, I need to find that right balance.
How geeky have you gone with cycling? Are you into... Obviously, Formula One is quite geeked out on coefficients of frontal drag, aero. Have you started going down that road and bringing bikes to wind tunnels?
Haven't had my bike yet in a wind tunnel, but Canyon takes care of that on their development. And I'm, yeah, quite heavily involved with Canyon as a brand, as one of their ambassadors. And they know what they're doing basically with bikes. But I'm a big fan of technology. I love seeing the innovative things popping up every now and then. How much the technology has improved even in the last few years is always really nice to follow, you know, what's coming up next. And yeah, I'm definitely interested in that kind of stuff. And when I do a gravel event myself, I don't leave any stone unturned. I wouldn't be on the start line without the best bits that you can possibly get. So
have you played around with core body temperature yet?
Yeah, I've been recording that every now and then. And yeah, I've kind of managed to find that correlation in terms of my feeling and what the data showed. And actually for a while now, I haven't used it. But yeah, there's so much tech as well in terms of the human performance and what you can measure, whether it's your core temp or glucose levels and stuff like that, and which is quite interesting.
Talk to me about your gravel event. You seem like a man who is spinning 100 plates already. Like, why take the plunge and start spinning another plate that just looks difficult to spin, setting up in a gravel race?
I just love riding my gravel bike. I love gravel events. That's the reason. And like anything that I am involved is normally true passion first. And yeah, gravel cycling is a big passion for me. And yeah, also, you know, with Finland Gravel that we hosted for the very first time in Lahti, Finland last year, that place is amazing place for gravel, and just really wanted to showcase what Finland can offer on that. And anyone who joined, they absolutely loved it. So yeah, it's really with passion and wanting to, you know, share the fun that I feel when I do a gravel event to the others.
When is it? I must try to get over and check it out.
Yeah, so it's June 15th this year in Lahti, Finland, and registration is open, finlandgravel.com, and we still got actually plenty of spaces left. It feels like Europe is a bit slow on waking up to the event and still deciding their calendars.
Yeah, it still feels like winter here. So I haven't committed to anything for the summer yet. Normally I'm like, oh, will I do Rift in July? But I'm like, weather's so bad. I'm going to look at that one. I want to talk high performance for a second. traveling all the way back to when you were growing up, do you think there was values that your parents instilled in you as a child that paved the way for your success now in later life?
My Woosh is hands down the best virtual cycling app for home, and it's redefining indoor training at no cost. Yep, it's absolutely free. And setting up My Woosh is really easy. Just download the My Woosh app, connect your device like your Watt bike or your smart trainer, and off you go. Now, if you're feeling competitive, there's weekly races for every category from beginner to pro. Plus, there's insane prize money up for grabs. Now, if you've no plan to race, that's no problem. There's hundreds of free training plans and workouts that are designed to really push you to your limits. You can enjoy daily group rides and group workouts, and you can customize your avatar all without opening your wallet. So go on over to the My Woosh app and have a look around. Why spend money on monthly subscriptions elsewhere when My Woosh offers all of this for free? So join My Woosh today. It's available on iOS, macOS, Google Play, Apple TV, or click on the link in the show notes to get started.
I would say the biggest thing I got to always thought that never give up, because then, yeah, if you don't try and if you give up along the way, then for sure you're not going to achieve your goals. I think that's the one that throughout my career since a kid, never willing to give up. I think that's probably the biggest one. But also learning from your mistakes. I think my parents really were good on guiding on that. That, yeah, if you mess up, if you do a mistake, it's you need to admit it. That's the first step. And that way you can make sure it doesn't happen again and you get better. So I would say two things, not giving up and learning from the mistakes, has been always the mindset I've been carrying since I get through.
Whenever I'm traveling, I seem to pick up and just gravitate in the airport towards Stoic philosophy books. And at the moment, I've been reading one of the Ryan Holiday ones, which is just sprinkled with these amazing quotes, but one of them is from Seneca. And he said, if one does not know to which port one is sailing, then no wind is favorable. Yeah, basically, do we know what our destination is? And do you think you had that vision when you were a kid? Like, did you have the posters on your wall of, you know, Michael Schumacher or your heroes at the time and almost dream it into reality?
Yeah, I was watching all the F1 races on TV. Obviously, that time it wasn't pay TV yet, so everything was broadcasted in Finland. I watched every race live, no matter which time it was. Which is like, yeah, cool memories, waking up, you know, 4 a.m., 5 a.m., excited to see the race. And then afterwards, I would go on my PlayStation and do the same track. And, you know, so definitely, luckily, I did realize what I want early on. I was 6 years old when I decided I want to be a Formula One driver. And yeah, at that point, it was a big dream. Obviously, when you're so young, you don't realize what it's going to take, but that's what I kind of decided. And I think then some years after, maybe when I was like 11, 12, I started to get a bit more clear picture on the goal and realized that if I want to get there, I need to focus all my energy into that goal and everything else needs to be secondary. And that's what I did. I'm glad it worked out, because otherwise, I don't know what I would be doing. Probably playing ice hockey, because that was my other sport in the winter. But yeah, so luckily early on I found that goal and found that path to follow and focus all my energy on that.
It's such a mesmerizing sport as a kid. I remember my dad used to be in the army and he'd take me into work. And one of my like most strongest memories from that period is just watching Formula One races in work with him. And I used to bring in my little, did you ever play Scale Electrics? I used to bring in my Scale Electrics set and play it on the ground. And I remember spraying one of the Scale Electrics cars red to be like Schumacher's Ferrari. But it's just so overpowering to your senses, Formula One, because it's, you know, it's rock and roll. It's amazing. It's a sensory overload.
Yeah, it is. It is. And for me, my hero as a kid was Mika Häkkinen, who was battling in the 90s with Michael. And why he was my hero, yeah, for sure, because he's from Finland, but you know, the way his career went. He had this difficult accident in 1995, went to coma, almost died, you know, but still managed to come back next season and got his first win eventually in 97. And then his titles in 98, 99. And for me, he was a hero because he definitely never gave up. And even with big setbacks, he always believed in his dream and always kept the focus. So yeah, I still remember watching his first win in 97. It was actually the race where Michael and Jacques Villeneuve crashed together in the last race of the season. And then Mika won it, and that was like amazing. And I knew immediately next year he's going to win the title, and so he did. That was cool to follow.
But how do you keep that focus? Because focus is a word you've dropped time and time again there. Focus, focus, focus. Because as you step up the level, and especially to where you are now, you know, only 20 seats at the top table, you must have more and more people trying to insert themselves into your life. And we have that old expression that you are the average of the five people you spend most time with. How purposeful do you have to be at curating that inner circle of five people?
Yeah, definitely something I've learned along the way. I feel like, yeah, once I got into Formula One, all of a sudden I had lots of friends. you know, everyone wanted to be my mate. And yeah, it's kind of, I think when you're young, it's kind of tricky to filter it out, like who's really your friend and who just wants to hang out with you because they think you're doing something cool and that they might benefit out of it somehow. But then along the way, you definitely learn to, let's say, smell, you know, the good people and the less good people and what are their intentions. And yeah, my like circle of friends that I could really call friends is quite small, which is nice. I don't need many friends. It's more about the quality than the quantity. And yeah, then in the end, you just learn to deal with it and you learn to do things in your way. For sure, sometimes you need to be a bit selfish, let's say, if you want to find your own time and still have that freedom to do things that you want to do instead of things that others want to do. So it's I've definitely learned that throughout the career. But like I said, when you're young, it's not always so easy.
My test is, as the podcast has sort of grown, it's like obviously nowhere near the level that you're getting, you know, artificial people inserting yourself into your life, but on a much smaller level. My test is, who would I give a call to help me move a couch? If I need somebody to lift a couch, who am I calling?
Exactly.
There's only four or five people in there.
Yeah, yeah, true. Yeah, there's not many people I would ask for that, but yeah. Good one.
I talked to Olaf Boo on the podcast. He's a triathlon coach. I'm not sure. Do you know Olaf?
I don't know him personally, no, but I know the name.
Interesting dude. Worth having a chat with if you ever get the opportunity. But he coaches the two very best triathletes in the world, Blumenfeld and Eden. It's an individual sport, obviously, and they're each other's biggest rivals. But what struck me when I was chatting to him, he's created a culture where two guys who are the biggest competitors with each other, as soon as one of them finds something that works, they find a new fueling strategy, they find an aerodynamic gain in the wind tunnel, the first thing they do, it's to share that information with their biggest rival. He's curated this environment where that's possible. And because of that, the two guys have just accelerated away from everyone else. There's them and then there's the rest and there's a huge gap. Formula One is a pretty unique sport in that it seems there's a inbuilt rivalry between the two drivers on a team. How do those two sit with the idea of sharing with someone close to you to level up versus that rivalry that's inherent within a team?
Yeah, that's tricky bit in the sport because for me and for anyone driving in Formula One, your direct comparison is your teammate because he is in the same car with same performance and so on. So yeah, you want to make sure for your future that you stay ahead of your teammate, at least overall in the season in terms of the amount of points you get. That's super important because if you are, let's say, always losing to a teammate, at some point you're out. That's how the sport works. But if you want to develop as a team for long term, then you need to work together. There can't be any hiding of the telemetry. If if another driver finds a different line or different way of driving or different things with the settings or setup, we share everything. We're actually obliged to share everything, but I don't mind doing it because it like you just explained with the two triathletes, it amplifies both of our performance in a weekend, but also in long term. And that's going to help the team as well to go forwards. And it is a real team sport. The team spirit plays a big part on everything. And the chemistry between the drivers, that reflects quite a lot I've seen to the team, how the atmosphere is, how the energy levels is. So it's super important to be able to be professional in that sense, that you are willing to, let's say, give some of your secrets away to your teammate, but in the long term, that's always going to be better.
Do you need a confidence to do that though? As a young driver, or if you're unsecure of your place in the team, as soon as you find a gain, is your natural instinct self-preservation rather than sharing? Hey, Rob, man, excuse the short interruption. I love riding the bike, but on account of being so busy with the podcast at the moment, I'm now what's called a time-crunched rider. I never thought I'd see the day, but I have a tool. I'm using Wattbike to keep myself sharp and on point with specific sessions to maximize that available training time. I have a Wattbike Adam right here in the recording studio beside me. And when I have an hour in between interviews, I jump on. It's removing all the friction points for me. There's no more 10-minute setup, unfolding legs, banging my knees off stuff, getting my hands dirty, the usual connection issues. It just works every single time. The Adam's perfect for virtual racing as well because it has crisp gear changes, it has 1% accuracy, and it has max gradient capability of up to 25%. If you're looking for an indoor trainer, I honestly couldn't recommend this any higher. I've been using a Wattbike since 2013. Honestly, it's the last indoor trainer that you're ever going to need. If you head on over to wattbike.com now and use code ROADMAN10, that's ROADMENTEN, and that's going to get you 10% off your Wattbike.
I think for me, I've now been quite a few years in this sport, and it has become normal. You know, the debriefs we do before and after each session, they're quite detailed, and naturally you go through every test item, you give your feedback on how it felt, all these things. So it comes naturally that you share everything, and then in the end it is up to the drivers when it comes to qualifying, when it comes to race, to see who finishes ahead with all the information we have shared.
The feedback loop is very important, whether we're talking Formula One, we're talking triathlon, or we're talking, you know, a high performance business environment. Is there a secret to cultivating that environment where you can openly give feedback and receive feedback without it turning into a conflict or without it being defensive?
Feedback is the key. You know, you need to be able to say things that you feel like can be improved or needs to be improved, and nothing in this sport shouldn't be taken personally. I think the teams are really aware of that, yeah, you need to be very straightforward with your feedback. You shouldn't feel bad on asking about something or saying that, okay, this doesn't work. You just need to say it as you feel, because that makes progress. If you try to be kind to everyone, then yeah, you probably will miss some of the things that you ideas you have and so on. So direct feedback is the key. And it's actually a very big part of the driver's job. Obviously, there's lots of sensors, there's lots of data that team is getting from the car. But then in the end, there is still this human element, the driver in the loop. So you need to give your feedback, like what do you feel like you need from the car to go faster in this race? Also, in long term, like when it comes to design and development ideas, you always need to think about what's next, because that's how the sport works.
Do you enjoy the job?
I do. I've always been enjoying the technical side. And I like to be overall, as a human, I like to be in control. That's when I'm most comfortable with things. And in this sport, when I get in my car, I get that sensation that, yeah, I'm in control and I continue to set up with the engineers and stuff, and that's a nice feeling.
Like when you're in the heat of battle, and you know there's going to be times where the nature of putting 20 alpha males into multi-million dollar supercars is there's going to be conflicts. There's going to be times when you lose your control. And just bringing it back and grounding it in a real world example for me, if I'm out on the bike cycling and I get a close pass from a car in traffic, I've been historically quite reactive to that. And I've let it spoil my spin. Sometimes I've chased after a driver and, you know, it's ended up in a confrontation. And with trying to be more mindful and stoic, what I've realized is there's a gap. There's a gap between the stimulus, that being the close pass, and my reaction. And I've tried to work really hard on extending the time of that gap. So by breathing and just saying, okay, take 2-3 deep breaths after this stimulus happens before you decide on what your reaction is going to be. And that's really helped me to kind of keep cool. Is there strategies or tactics that you use to keep cool in the heat of battle?
I think naturally I'm quite a calm person and don't get, let's say, heated up that easily. I feel like I'm quite good on controlling my emotions, but sometimes I can't help it, you know, in the race if, yeah, things turn to shit or something happens that really frustrates me. Sometimes when you are competing, when you are, your body is high on adrenaline, you know, if you're in that moment, sometimes it's just impossible to control yourself. You just open the radio and you shout whatever comes from inside. That just happens sometimes, which is quite funny. Then thinking afterwards, like, oh, that wasn't that nice to that person or this person. But yeah, you know, in competition, sometimes you can't help it. But like I said, mostly I'm okay.
Who's the most dangerous driver?
Most dangerous driver.
I suppose there's two answers to this question, isn't there? There's probably a big data, statistically, X person is the most dangerous driver. And then there's the answer that probably we all care about is like, who do you think the most dangerous driver is?
Yeah, I mean, I think now I feel like on the field, there's no one that really stands out as a dangerous driver. Actually, like if you go back a few years ago, I would probably have said Max, just the way he competes. But he's matured a lot. I think now he's calculating a bit more the risks than before. He would just always go for it. Now, I would still go for someone pretty young who's still lacking a bit of experience. But honestly, I can't say a name. Like, there's nobody that really stands out. But normally, the more you have experience, then the less dangerous you are.
What's your relationship like with Max?
It's good. Yeah, he's all right. I mean, yeah, he's in a good place at the moment, dominating the sport. So that's why he's pretty chilled and laid back and happy. But yeah, he's all right.
There's not like a historical vein of conflict from your Mercedes days and the kind of duels you would have had with the Red Bulls back then?
No. I think in this sport, typically people forget things quite quickly and move on and get on with it.
How much of a change was it moving from Mercedes? I suppose you could almost divide your career into two chapters, Mercedes and then non-Mercedes. Going from being in the very best car in the world to not being in the best cars in the world, how big a change is that?
It's a big change. Like, I was, you know, I had quite a bit of time to mentally prepare for it because I knew that, yeah, it's probably going to be a few years that I'm going to be back on the podium or having results like that at least. But I took it as a project. That was my approach that, yeah, it's a long-term project. Yeah, it might be difficult. It will be difficult. It will be hard work, but I've been just trying to think that how rewarding it will feel eventually if we get to the goals that we have set. You know, going through that, let's say, harder period of time, then achieving something after, I think that would be even more rewarding than being in a car that you're almost guaranteed to going to be on the podium, you know? So that's the motivation now is the progress and to get back up there and thinking how good that will feel when it happens.
Do you think it's actually harder for Lewis in some ways than it is for you? Because at least you had that conscious choice that, okay, now I'm going to be in a car that's not as fast, where he's had to be a part of a program that's just slowly lost their edge.
I think it's been hard for the whole team, actually, because Mercedes was dominating for quite a long time. And when I was there, we won five constructors titles in a row. Since then, that hasn't happened. And when you're used to winning, and if you're not winning anymore, it's painful. And seems like they're still trying to find their way in terms of the car design and everything. But probably part of the reason why Lewis went. I think he needs something new, something refreshing, a new challenge project, which I'm sure he's going to enjoy that.
You still friends with Lewis?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's get on really well. Some of us travel together, and
can he ride a bike?
No, he doesn't like to ride a bike. He said his butt hurts when he does that, so that's his excuse.
Do you think he can win an 8th Drivers' Championship?
I see no reason why not. I think he's still on a great level, but for that, he just needs the car. You know, that's the sport. If you want to win the title, you need to be in the best car, because the gaps between the drivers is quite small. So if he can lift up Ferrari's performance in the future, then absolutely.
What's the shelf what's the shelf life on drivers? You know, obviously it's not an endurance sport in the traditional sense, but there's still huge physical requirements on you guys. You know, where do you think the age, obviously Alonso's, you know, no spring chicken. I don't know what age he is off the top of my head, but is there an age in your mind where drivers start to decline?
Yeah, so I think Fernando is now about 42, something like this, and he's a bit of an outlier, let's say, in nowadays Formula One. I think Lewis will be next year 40, I think. So, I mean, I feel like Fernando's age, that's pushing it. It's individual, of course, everyone ages differently, but it is a fact that at some point with age, your reaction time starts to get slower, your decision-making process starts to get slower, but obviously, example for him hasn't happened yet. When it will happen, who knows? But it's quite a wide range nowadays. Like, yeah, you can be 18, you can be competitive, or you can be low 40s and still be fine. So I'm now 34, so I still got some time, and got some time to get back on the podiums eventually.
Something that's fascinating about Formula One to me, it is that car. It's you guys all have different cars, so I find it difficult to answer the underlying question of who's the best driver. Like, is Max actually the best driver? Is Lewis the best driver? Are you the best driver? Is there a consensus?
It's hard to say. You know, if everyone would have the same car, that's how we would find out in the course of the season. I think it's quite easy. It would be easy to say now that Max is up there, because he is obviously in the best car, but he's also destroying his teammate. In terms of current form, if I would have to guess somebody, I would probably say Max. He's a very complete driver. He's super talented, but now also a talent with experience. When I was at Mercedes and when I left from Mercedes, I was very clear that Lewis was the best driver out there, which for me was kind of hard to accept, because you always need to believe that you are the best. The numbers, they didn't lie. You know, 5 years in a row overall, he always somehow managed to beat me. Obviously, on my best day, I could do that. Which is a good feeling. But over the course of the season, how dynamic he was, how his position was in the team, I couldn't find a way to beat him. But I would go for Max or Lewis.
Do you enjoy the pressure to perform? There's no job I can think that's as result-driven. You know, people will talk about traders, Wall Street guys, they're salespeople, they live and die by their quarterly sales. but there's only 20 seats at the top table. You're racing literally every weekend for your contract, it seems. Does that stress empower you or does it break you down? Rob Mann, I know how serious you take your goal setting, whether they're fitness or life-related goals. If you're looking for a powerful ally to support you on this journey, look no further than Huel. Huel has become my secret weapon for when I don't have time to prepare a balanced meal. It ensures I get the nutrition I need without sacrificing time or taste. Plus, it stops me from reaching for that takeaway menu. I always throw a bottle into my backpack when I'm heading into the city to work, and it stops me eating junk convenience foods, snacking on croissants and bars of chocolate, because I know they don't support my training goals. It's a handy, nutritious meal on the go, and it's got over 22 grams of protein. Huel is perfect for athletes that don't have time to cook or prepare food before a training session. It's convenient, nutritious fuel at your fingertips, ensuring you hit your daily fueling needs for that session. Huel Ready to Drink has 26 essential vitamins and minerals in every single bottle. You're getting a whopping 175 health benefits. Plus, it's made from natural ingredients like tapioca, sunflower seed, coconut, and more. The best part? It's the flavors. There's 8 crazy, beautiful flavors. Iced coffee is what's in my backpack right at the moment. You can get Huel directly to your home. All you got to do is head on over to the Huel website, huel.com/roadman.
You get used to it. You know, I got pretty thick skin, let's say, at Mercedes years because I had a long-term contract, but every year was a different option. And the option was always on the team. So every year I almost had this knife on my throat that if I don't perform, I'm out. So year after year, it starts to get exhausting. And I only realized then when I signed with Alpha Sauber for a 3-year contract that it felt like big weight left my shoulders, because actually having that stability, knowing that, yeah, okay, this is where I'm going to be for the next years. That's the goal. Almost could breathe, you know, a bit easier. So it is stressful if you're on the knife edge, let's say. But again, with the career, as you go further and further, you just learn better to deal with it. And you learn that the best pressure is the one from yourself. And once you get to the point that you can actually control it, that's ideal. And I feel like I've definitely got there, that only pressure that I have is that affects me is only my own one, nothing from the outside.
What motivates you at this point in your career? You know, you didn't share your bank account details with me before the call, but I'm thinking there's a pretty big number in that account. So it can't be money. It can't be status. It's like, no, what motivates you to get up and do this every day?
You know, it's definitely not money. I would be happy just if there was no Formula One, just riding my gravel bike, doing a bit more gravel races, simple life, maybe have a van, go around.
Come and co-host the podcast with me.
Yeah, sure. it's obviously not that, but what motivates me now is I want to get back to podiums and back to winning eventually. So yeah, that's the motivation for me. And I kind of failed on winning the world championship with Mercedes. I was a couple of times second. So that dream is still there. But now the next step is to be on the podium and then to win a race. And then we go from there. But how and when that's going to happen, I don't know. That's the beauty of this sport. You never know how things change. You never know which teams are going to be strong, where you end up. And actually, yeah, for the very first time in a few years now, I'm fully open in terms of the contract situation. I'm basically on open market in terms of the contract. So that's quite exciting because I think there's going to be quite a bit of movement for 2025 onwards.
Does the risk to reward ratio change for you season on season? When you come into Formula One for the first time and you get the big paycheck, you know, you're taking risks. Obviously, every week you're dealing with the chance of death in a more explicit way than in any other profession in the world. But as you start to accumulate more and more wealth, you have this safety net where you're like, okay, maybe I don't need to take the same risks I did when I was in year one, year two. Do you think about that at all? Do you think about your own mortality and that risk to reward ratio changing?
No, I don't think about it. Like, I think it's when you get it in the car, when you put the racing helmet on, you get this illusion that nothing can happen to you as long as you're in control. It's only when you lose control and, you know, whether somebody hits you or you lose the car in the corner, you're about to hit the wall. That's the only uncomfortable situation that it doesn't feel good. But when you're in the car in control, yeah, you don't think about it. You just want to maximize whether it's a qualifying lap or whether it's a racing situation. You just want to maximize the situation and kind of deal with the consequences later. I think that's something you need to have if you want to be a driver.
You have a unique calmness about you. I've chatted with about 950 people on podcasts over the past couple of years. You're a very calm individual. I want to peel back your brain for a second and try and figure out what's going on inside that head.
Yeah, sure.
So when you're sitting down to watch YouTube in the evenings, like, you know, what are you flicking on? What are you watching?
Actually, I don't watch YouTube that much. There's too many ads and stuff going on.
I'll give you the cheat code here, Valtteri. You got to take €10 a month and upgrade to premium, bro. It's only €10
a
month.
Just get rid of ads.
Really? It gets rid of ads, yeah.
Good to know. I'll do that tonight. YouTube. If I got YouTube, I would actually watch probably some fails, maybe. Something funny stuff. Sometimes I do watch some bike stuff, whether it's about a bike tech. If something new has come up, I will try to find some stuff about that. Sometimes I do watch some car reviews if I'm thinking about changing my road car or getting a new one. Stuff like that. Nothing unusual.
What do you think about the big YouTubers like David Goggins and that kind of motivational nature?
It's good for them. Obviously, it's good business as well. So good for them. And it's nice that nowadays, just online, you can share so much to people that wasn't really possible before. And and it's great opportunities for many young YouTubers as well. You know, if you find a way to do something different, there's you can actually make a great career out of it, which is cool.
What you have, this, I don't know how to throw a blanket over it, we'll call it high performance. What you have is something that they try to replicate. My girlfriend used to be working in a big pharmaceutical company, Johnson & Johnson, and they would have speakers coming in all the time, like, you know, some F1 drivers, Olympic medalists, all black rugby players. They'd come in and they'd encourage them to tell their stories with the goal of some of this high performance rubbing off. I'm not sure if you've heard Hulk Hogan on Joe Rogan. He talks about this idea, the rub. You can get the rub if you hang around the right type of people. Do you think you can teach high performance, or do you need to find it by yourself?
I think part of it you can teach. I think you can always, I think it helps to hear other people's experiences on how they got to a certain point. What it took, what was their mindset, what they've learned. I think it definitely can help with your journey on getting where you want to be, is to listen others and listen advice. But I think you need to be really careful who you listen to, because in the end, every human being is individual and not everything works for everyone. You know, you need to find your own way, but I wouldn't be afraid of taking advice, but always have your own filter and follow your gut as well.
If you knew right now, if you had all your knowledge from right now and you could pass some specific tippet or piece of knowledge back to yourself at the very start of this journey, what would you whisper in your own ear?
I wouldn't say too much, because I've made a good career already. Only thing... I do sometimes think about this. Only thing I would say, especially on my first years with Mercedes, I would have told myself to give myself a bit more time, because when I got to that team, I wanted to win immediately. I wanted to beat Lewis immediately. And I was really, really hard on myself, too hard on myself, and creating too much unnecessary pressure. So I'll probably tell myself to calm down a bit and give yourself a bit more time, take it step by step. And that's pretty much the only thing I would say, but otherwise wouldn't say too much.
We started out the podcast and we were talking about this idea of having a filter that you are the average of the five people you surround yourself with. Is high performance lonely? You know, is that filter something that you maybe filter out meaningful connections?
No, it doesn't need to be. Like I said, like I've got, a few good friends that I can really rely on. I've got my family, got my partner that I can speak anything about. So no, high performance doesn't need to be lonely, because in the end, high performance is human performance. And to be at your best and to be good in human performance, you need all these areas in life in balance. You know, otherwise, it's not sustainable. So yeah, you can't do anything alone really in this world, because you have the support of others that you can get energy out from and you can get advice. It doesn't need to be long.
It's good to know you have a few lads you can move a couch with.
Yeah, a few lads to have a pint with.
Valtteri, thank you for your time, my friend.
Yeah, thank you. My pleasure.
So if you like this video, you should definitely check out this video, because I know you're going to love it. And don't forget to subscribe to the channel.